We'll be listening to the wonderful, wonderful, wonderful Einstein and Gogo. See you in a week's time.
Einstein and Gogo.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Einstein the Go-Go. I'm Dr. Shane. Thanks so much for tuning in to Triple R for an hour of science. A big thank you to the team from radiotherapy for bringing us through to 11. You're stuck with us now until we hand over to Edith at 12. In the studio with me is Chris KP. Good morning.
Oh, hello there.
Perky as ever.
Sorry. I'm sure it's in the brief somewhere it mentioned that, didn't
it? Well, you know, yeah, it's nice.
Have I ever told you about there was a young man who was serving at a cash register in a supermarket once, and yeah. I've never got past this because his attitude was brilliant, and it was just to act surprised. So you turn up with your bag of chips and your thing of meat, and you go, hello?
That's
like he hadn't seen you for 20 years, and it just felt incredibly welcoming.
My most memorable moment in the supermarket while we're on it is when I rocked up once when I like a certain type of tea.
Sure.
Normally about $12 a box. I should say, hi, Dr. Susan.
Hi.
How are you going there? Yeah.
I'm trying to think about my favourite supermarket moment. I don't have one.
Anyway, and these things are about $12 a box. So I bought about 10 of them because they were half price. Right. And I'm a saver. I'm very frugal. I'm a saver. And the woman who served me, she said, bit of a problem, have we?
Oh, no.
It's an addict. It's a problem addict. The alert button under the table is pressed.
The best part was that. I mean, like, what made her day, I think I said, yes, my name's Shane, and I do have a problem with tea. It was just a very good interaction.
That's nice.
Oh, you can take that everywhere.
I really appreciated her humour, and I'm sure some people wouldn't have, but I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
I thought it was very nice. And
that's what the self-checkout is for, so you don't get alienated by the checkout lady.
And now, whenever I buy things in bulk, I'm disappointed.
Oh, everyone else is a letdown. Yeah. The bar is too high.
Well, they just look at you like you're a cheapskate or something. I was like, no, I have a problem.
This is my problem.
Yes, indeed. Anyway, well, we've got three guests sitting in the green room today. It's going to be a pretty good show.
It is.
I think they're looking very excited out there.
Oh. I love that. I love when the excitement wins over the nervousness.
Yeah.
I have to tell myself this every Sunday.
Yeah, well, you know, and look, everyone's gone to the bathroom, so we're good. I mean, that's always the first thing that happens.
The queue was long.
Yeah, and now we've settled and we're good to go.
For me, it's a great Sunday. I found the cup with the biggest German flag on it. I'm set here.
I noticed that.
I know. Yeah. And it's like it was right in front and center, and I'm like, they've made this for me.
It was meant to be.
Is something happening in the world that this is relevant to, Susie?
No, it's just that I feel like home.
Oh, okay.
Wow, a mug made you. Wow.
I know. And so he
German
has the tea
tourism
problem,
has just got a lot cheaper.
Interesting. There we go.
And he's got the tea problem.
Indeed. All right, we better get into some science news. Chris KP, what's been interesting to you this week?
I found this story that appealed to me for a number of reasons, but one of them is because it's one of those stories that is, it's not, okay, this is going to sound silly, it's not finished. It's like we've done a bit of research and gone, here we go, there's the answer. It's one of those, here's the research, bit. Here's the question.
Here's another puzzle piece.
And it also appeals to me because it's kind of about, look, I think it's reasonable to suggest that everybody in this studio right now has got habits they'd like to change.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to talk about it here. It's okay, it's not therapy, but we all have them.
Some of them have to do with tea.
Many of them have to do with tea. But that's okay. So we have issues. And sometimes you can break those habits, but often it's just the thing that becomes not, it's just part of what you do and how you operate.
Right.
So, here's the story. And it's wonderfully classic. Bunch of mice that are in a maze, and there is a treat in the maze, and they learn the
classic
track.
Classic setup.
It's so good. It's so good. They find their way to the food. Because they're not idiots, right?
Mm.
And so the next day, they go into the maze, and they make their way. And after a while, they know exactly where this is. They know every turn and bend, and they find the food time after time after time without even... It's just automatic.
Mm-hmm.
And then the scientists, because, of course, they're scientists... Move the food.
Of course it
is. So the mice go down their path and there's nothing there. Like, oh, come on. And eventually they find it. They do find it.
Yeah.
And then the next day, you know, some of them find it again. But many of them still have that first memory going to the wrong place first.
Hmm.
What they found...
Like it's habitual.
Well, it's habitual, but they're tracking in their brains what's going on. And they found the neurotransmitter that they think is associated with changing your habits.
Uh-oh.
Yes. Acetylcholine. Acetylcholine.
I'm not
is
sure
the
I
thing.
Like where this is going.
Well, neither do I. I mean, yeah, you're thinking supplements, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. But it might also just be, it might be more a case of, okay, so basically the more acetylcholine they had and the quicker they had it, the more able they were to make a new pattern. That's what it boils down to, essentially. Although extremely cool technology that they could track this in real time as well. But I'm thinking, okay, so the completely BS supplement is the bad news. The good news is twofold, though. Firstly, it opens the door to, we need to understand this more, what is actually going on, what's the mechanism more deeply, what's the sequencing. But the other part of it that really appeals to me is, what if you could do a check? We could say, yeah, you're really low on acetylcholine. Then it doesn't mean you need more of it. It just means you need to think about behavior change differently.
Yeah,
if I'm loaded
right.
with it, I might be really quick.
You need some behavior that like triggers the release of it or something like that.
Or you just accept that it's going to take longer.
Huh.
You need more tactics. Huh. It also has implications for things like OCD. Like there are serious neurological conditions where
triggering.
This is...
Triggering.
Yeah.
Events. Yep, yep.
So it's, which is, I think, great that we're now just going, oh, yeah, you've got a problem. You know, here's some sympathy
pill.
And some, or a magic pill. It's like a matter, or here's a, you know, here's
what
something.
What do you need? Someone to listen or a pill to swallow?
Is it always the choice? But anyway, so I thought that was cool. Acetylcholine as being one of the keys to understanding.
But it has
habit.
So many functions, doesn't it? Like, I feel like this is one of the molecules that comes up a lot when it comes to
neurocellular
function. Yeah.
Yes, that surprised me too. I'm sort of going, you haven't noticed this before? This has been picked up in lots of things, and apparently not. There you go.
Because there's some habits I wouldn't mind. Yeah.
I just want a magic pill to be like, go to the gym every day. Here, swallow this pill, and you'll do that.
Yeah.
Snap muscles.
But if you have trouble breaking habits, then that might be a ripper because once you get into going to the gym, that's it.
Yeah.
You're going to the gym.
Imagine you like form a habit you don't want, you know. It's like suddenly you're addicted to cigarettes and you don't know why. You've never had them in your life.
Well, we all have those problems.
It could be a habit you want. Like, I've been doing this show for 32 years. People sometimes say, you know, what keeps you going? And now I'm just going to say, acetylcholine. It's nothing to do with me. I got no choice.
I don't even like it.
And yet I show up here every Sunday.
I have to look up the location of the station every week. I don't know where I'm going.
Oh, well, the biggest problem is when they move the studio and you're wandering around in circles for days.
It's like, for some reason, I sit in the car at 10 a.m. every Sunday. I don't know why.
I've got an addiction. Along with the tea, I've got a problem. Give me those pills. I have my Sundays back.
I'll do my best.
Dr. Susie, what do you got for us?
Well, I got a bit of a personal story because I'm busy.
Did you love the responses there? Chris like, said, no, good. And I said, uh-oh.
Love that for me.
Yeah.
At the end of that, both of you be like, uh-oh. That's fine. No. So I stumbled upon this because there's a little bit of a backstory to it, which is very personal, which is I'm a busy person. And sometimes, you know, when you had a long day and you had friends over for dinner and it's like past midnight, you can't be asked washing up all the dishes. So in my household, this is a matter of leave it for tomorrow. Maybe the dogs get it. Who knows? We'll deal with it when the sun is up. And the problem in Australia, particularly when it's a change of season, is that you wake up in the morning and the first thing you deal with is not the dishes, it's a trail of ants in the house. And I hate it. I mean, I'm glad I'm not in Sydney because there would be cockroaches, but, you know, ants.
Yeah.
And so I'm a chemist, so my solution to everything is chemistry. And so the first thing I do is...
You set fire to the house.
Yeah, no.
Okay, good.
Not quite. That would be physics. Anyway, I get the ant rid out because I'm just like, you are annoying, go to help.
Right, okay.
So I get the ant out, and then, you know, and then I go down the rabbit hole of while I watch all the ants trail into the ant because it attracts them, how it works, you know, wadi wadi wah. And then I got on a really, really deep rabbit hole about science of ants and, you know, ant and pest control. And then I stumbled upon this story, which again makes me feel like home because it comes from the University of Regensburg in Germany, which is close enough to my home, same state. So I claim this as from a home. And they were studying that you can actually add supplements to ants to make them do their task, as in finding food and bringing it back, more precise. As in not faster, they can't, you know, walk faster, don't suddenly become Usain Bolt of the ants, but they're usually, when you see them trailing, you know, they leave the pheromone trail, and in the, especially in the beginning, they're quite a little bit disoriented, so they get left, right, you know, before they find the rough direction. So it's a bit of a, not a straight line. And then they found if they add caffeine to the whatever sugary substance that they lure them with, that line becomes suddenly bolt straight.
Wow.
So, and you would think, oh, yeah, I mean, they have a pheromone trail now. They know what they're doing. No, they made this labyrinth in a way that they've attracted the ants by, you know, a sugary drop with caffeine, send them back, and then changed the paper, like the walkway in between, so it was no trace of to be found. And you could see that the ants still chose a more direct path. So the way from going to the bait and back became a lot faster. In fact, it became faster by, I think, what was it, 35% or something? So a decent increase in how fast you could deliver things like bait, like antrid, you know, so like killing ants. Now, there's all the animal lovers out there that go to the extreme and say, why would you kill all the ants? You know, they don't do any harm. And I'm like, that is so fair. The ants in my kitchen are mainly just annoying to me. But there are ant species out there in the wild that are doing a lot of harm. One of them is the ones they studied, which is the Argentine ant, which is, the name suggested, native to Argentina. And they are so bad, they are killing native invertebrates and like basically replacing them there and become a massive invasive species that like changes the ecosystem of, you know, their whole fauna and flora, basically. And that's really, really bad. And they're huge as well. So they eat like little chicken eggs and chicken chicks and whatnot. It's quite brutal. And the problem is with those, they, if you leave the bait out for too long, eventually they, you know, become adapted to them and be like, well, I'm not interested in that anymore. I'm moving on, you know, no ants, not enough ants dead. And so having a way of delivering, you know, pest control in a more efficient way, just by using caffeine is like, you know, it's like,
I like it.
The morning glory of ant rid.
I love the fact that, you know, the ants on caffeine also get a bit distracted.
Yes.
So like, I had that yesterday. What's going on now?
Stimulant.
That's very cool. Well, let me mention something quickly just to blow your minds, all your minds out there listening. Thank you for listening. The Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, otherwise known as DESI, reported the end of its first five-year survey this week. So this is installed on a telescope over in Arizona. And the goal was to essentially do a full map spectroscopically of the universe, which was pretty cool. And it is there to essentially study, you know, where we might find dark energy. And if you haven't been keeping up, folks, and I understand if you haven't, the universe is made up of three parts. There's dark energy. We don't know what it is, where it is. We can't see it. 70%. There's dark matter. Mm-hmm. We don't know what it is, where it is. Well, we kind of know where it should be, but we don't know what it is.
But it's not proven.
And 25%. And then there's us.
5%.
5%. Yeah. Lousy 5%. So, you know, pretty sad.
But, noisy 5%.
But a lot of this is theoretical, so, you know, like, but anyway, this is an interesting mapping experience. And I think what's really cool about this one is it also looks, it's not just where they're looking, it's also when they're looking. So the mapping is sort of three-dimensional in time. So it looks back through a period of about 11 billion years, which is kind of wild. So that you think of this map that's not just of structure, but also of time. It brings in another dimension. And this is the bit that I want you, everyone at home can just, you know, sit yourself down and think about this for a while. The survey data has observed something akin to a little more than 47 million, not stars, galaxies.
Seriously?
47 million galaxies in the survey.
That's a lot of stars.
And so if you actually get online and you look up DESI, D-E-S-I, the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, you should be able to find the data and you can have a look at it. And you'll see this sort of what looks like a whole of the stars. They're actually not stars, they're galaxies.
Crazy.
So it's wild stuff. Wild stuff. This is so, and to be fair, they haven't really started examining this data yet. You know, they just got it in. They've started compiling it and released it for people to look at. But it's pretty fascinating.
And everything's changed since then as well, because some of the data is what, 5 years old now.
It's very, very old. Most of the data is from millions and billions of years old. But
11
billion data
years. That's insane.
It's
that
cool
number
stuff.
Is like mind-boggling insane.
It's not easy for us to comprehend as humans.
It's too big a number.
But anyway, I think it's fascinating we're starting to get these really large-scale structural images of the universe that we've never had before with some of these new instruments and these new telescopes.
Really what that tells us is we're a very noisy, loud minority.
Oh. Well, and thankfully, due to the speed of light, no one else can hear us.
That's right, yes.
Shout in the void, you know.
Yeah, by the time it gets to them, we'll be long gone.
Yeah, that's such a good image. Futile noise.
Yeah, futile noise.
No one cares.
No one cares.
Keep screaming.
No one cares. And even if they did, it wouldn't reach them for a very long
Way
time.
Way to make our listeners feel insignificant.
Unless there's someone on a very nearby star, and then you've got a short turnaround.
Which case it was like
decades. Yeah. So, yeah. I'll leave you with that thought, folks. Just try and count those galaxies while you're having your breakfast or your brunch or whatever we're up to. You're listening to Einstein and Go-Go. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with our first guest in just a few minutes.
How much longer can you escape the crushing guilt of not subscribing? Triple R's April Amnesty is on now. Subscribe by April 30th and go into the running to win any of the following prizes. Win a Multipass 12 for MIF 2026, providing you with 12 standard festival sessions that you can enjoy by yourself or share with friends and family. MIF 2026 runs from August 6 to 23. A one-year subscription to Walker's Journal, a publication focused on urban, coastal and overland adventures, and a one-year subscription to the architectural publication Green Magazine. A $300 voucher to spend on either the bar or retail store at Natural Science Wine and Liquor. A one-year subscription to Mount Zero's Olive Oil Club, including enough extra virgin olive oil to last you an entire year. A professional photo session for your dog or cat from Instinct Pet Photography. Subscribe and donate this April Amnesty at rrr.org.au. 50 years of Triple R.
MUMA, Monash University Museum of Art, presents Shuana Spong, Ha Ha Ha, the first solo exhibition in Australia of London-based Balinese Aotearoan artist Shuana Spong. Exploring mist as metaphor and phenomenon, Ha 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 spans film, sculpture and textile. Attend the opening Thursday, April 23rd at 6 p.m. with talks, a rare performance of the gamelan diggle and musical activation of Spong's instrument sculptures presented with liquid architecture. MUMA, Triple R sponsors.
The federal government lets big gas take 56% of gas exports for free. Research from the Australia Institute shows Australian students pay more in HECS than gas companies pay in petroleum tax. And Australian nurses pay more in tax than the gas industry. For anyone who thinks this isn't fair, head to australiainstitute.org.au to show your support by donating or signing their petition. Authorised by the Australia Institute, Canberra. Triple R sponsors.
Welcome back, folks. You're listening to Einstein and Go-Go on 3
We don't need microphones here. That's fine.
I pushed the wrong button. I got there. You know, I got there eventually. In the studio with us now is Gabriel Abrams. And Gabriel is a PhD student from the University of Oxford. Gabriel, welcome to Triple R.
Thanks so much for having me.
What are you doing out here?
I know. I was like, Oxford?
I guess congratulations to Nina and Gus. My cousin has just got married. So
Oh, congratulations. I knew there was a junket going on somewhere.
You reckon they paid him to come out and do this?
Well, I don't know. You're partway through your PhD over there?
Yes, towards the end.
Towards the end. You work on, fluorescence imaging and imaging of parts of the body. So give us a bit of an idea first. How do we normally do this and what are the limitations in the sort of techniques we use?
Yeah, so in all of biology, in fact, not just humans, if we're trying to image microbes or we're trying to image animals or mice, it's really useful to be able to see where some area of biology is being activated or where a drug is going. And one thing researchers have found a decade or two ago is you can take glowing proteins that come from, for example, jellyfish. Mm-hmm. They glow green. And so if you attach them to the thing you're interested in, now that will go green. And biology is amazing. You can transfer this DNA from the jellyfish into any other organism and suddenly it will start glowing green.
Yep. I remember, I don't hang out with many bio people. I try not to, but you know, they do get very excited about fluorescence imaging. And I think because now it's not just green, is it? They can tag them with all different fluorophores and all different colors. And so you can see different components and how they're interacting.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's been a huge effort to engineer these proteins. So to make mutations to them in various ways to design them so that they will have different colors, different spectra, different brightnesses. So a lot of optimization, and that's kind of what's made them so useful. So if you just take the original protein, it's not necessarily the kind of tool that it is today, but with a lot of effort, it's become this very robust way of imaging things.
Yeah. So what are you doing that's different, and why?
So I'm working with... some proteins are also glow green, but uniquely they respond to magnetic fields.
Okay.
So we can apply a magnetic field, which means like bring a fridge magnet nearby, and the glowing will kind of decrease.
Right.
We can then take the magnet away and the glowing will increase, and we can do this very repeatedly.
So while it's in the cell or the biological specimen...
Yeah, absolutely. In a living animal, you can do this. And, I mean, almost nothing in biology interacts with magnetic fields. So this was a sort of huge discovery just a couple of years ago. And I say discovery, it was really an engineering discovery, right? This is not a natural protein.
Yeah, so this is a protein, the protein itself is responsive to magnetic field, is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
So does that mean, is the protein itself magnetic, or is it just like, you know...
Yeah.
How does that interaction work?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So originally, people had no idea, which is another kind of crazy thing. It was engineered by looking at the glow, bringing magnets nearby, and you could select for this effect without knowing what was actually going on. So kind of evolution is an amazing thing, right? Nature doesn't have to understand the details to make it happen.
Work. Yeah.
And so a lot of the work that I did was to try and understand actually what's going on. What we found is it's not... like a magnet, it's actually electrons interacting in a quantum mechanical way. And it turns out that you can kind of separate the energy levels of these electrons with magnetic fields, and through a kind of mechanism that eventually leads to a change in the fluorescence. So the proteins are not magnetic, but they are magnetically sensitive.
Oh, that's nice. Wild. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, you know, we know that in engineering of quantum computers of any type, the external environment and interference from that environment is the killer. You know, it causes so many problems. But essentially what you're talking about is using that external environment as a mechanism to make change, right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of what is so surprising and amazing and exciting, is that this works in a living organism. So somehow the protein is providing the same kind of shielding that you would need, you know, not for like a Google quantum computer, but similar to other physics. We have like diamonds that can do quantum sensing, and they work using very similar physics. And so now we have a protein that manages to shield sufficiently from the environment for long enough that these quantum effects last for long enough to have this, you know, observable outcome.
So whenever I think about magnetic fields and I think about imaging, my brain immediately goes to magnetic resonance imaging. And because, you know, like, or as I like to call it, nuclear magnetic resonance imaging, just to freak people out. But I grew up in the 70s and 80s, so that's what we call it. But, you know, the idea that anything that, you know, you can alter its orientation or what it's doing with magnetic fields means that you can kind of do stuff at a distance, which is pretty cool. So with this protein, can you start to do the sort of imaging that you would, you know, in some way compare to like what we do in MRI machines?
Yeah, exactly. So MRI works by kind of it almost the same thing. It works by changing the energy levels of, I think, hydrogen in water molecules in your body. And in our case, we change the energy levels of an electron inside the protein. So it's actually the same as MRI at that stage of it. The difference is in MRI, you can then detect kind of radio signals coming out from that water, whereas here we detect the change in the fluorescence.
Right.
And what that means, though, is that we can image where the protein is using the fluorescence. So you're not, and when I say that, it's like, well, yes, you just look and then you see where it's glowing. In this case, you look at how the glow changes over time, and that signal is changing in a way that if you're applying magnetic fields and radio fields in a precise way, you can look at how the fluorescence is changing, and from that determine where it is, and you know where that protein is.
When you talk about this, I'm seeing, like, you know, rabbits and rats and whatever not that have just like on off you know, light effects, like a strobe light now. I'm assuming it's not quite like that, quite that intense. And how strong is this effect? This is like quite a low signal, you know, where you have to get really high end detectors to even find it, or is it something you can see with the, you know, with your bare eye, which you, if you can.
So for it to be like kind of useful in this way. It has to be quite a large effect, actually. It's not at the point where you could just look at it and see with your eye, but it is at the point where you can look at it. You could use your phone, for example, take a long exposure photo, oh, right. Okay. And if you took two photos in a row, one with the magnet there and one without it, you would see the difference.
That's pretty fancy.
That's
so it is a strobe effect. I love it.
Disco bunny.
Yes.
So, Gabriel, what does this allow us to sort of track in the body that we otherwise can't do with other techniques that we have?
Yeah, so this could allow us to track, for example, where a drug is going in a for example, a mouse model. Mm-hmm. And I say that because you still have to see the fluorescence. So
right.
Probably you can't image something deep inside the human body. It's still the light has to get out somehow.
Yep.
But people already do fluorescence imaging in animals, but they have the problem that the light kind of goes everywhere, right? So you want to know where it's coming from, but really it has to go through all these cells and it scatters mm-hmm. about and you just see a vague glow at the end. In our case, you still see the vague glow, but that vague glow is pulsating in a way that tells you exactly where in 3D space it was coming from.
Yeah, it's wild stuff. Now, earlier on in the interview, you said that, you know, magnetic field stuff and that is not in biology typically. You know, we don't see that. What about things like birds that do navigation? I mean, is there a component of them that is doing exactly the sort of stuff that this protein is doing?
Yeah, so perhaps. There are certainly animals and birds that can navigate with magnetic fields. The question is exactly how are they doing this? And there are various mechanisms that have been proposed, one of which is a protein that exists in the bird's retina, and it has the same kind of physics as the protein that we work with, but actually linking that protein directly to the bird makes a decision is very difficult, and there's other kind of possible mechanisms as well. So they have, I think, in their ear or nose, there's like a coil type structure which could also, for example, detect magnetic fields.
Yeah. Do you think you know, because some people have a good sense of direction, do you think they've got more of this protein floating around?
Perhaps. I mean, the question is, if they close their eyes, can they still see the magnetic field?
Oh, Australia really like ruins this, actually.
Yeah.
Every time when I came back to Australia, I went in the wrong direction, because like you have like the internal, this is where north is, and then you're on the other side of the globe, and I'm like, why am I walking southwards? I wanted to go north, and it's like, it just messes
you
up.
That's okay. You're like a walking GPS. You've automatically corrected yourself, so you're heading back to pole.
And then what do I do? Just lay on the ground and like do figure eights to
to like rearrange yourself. Yeah, is that what you were doing? I guess it makes so much sense now.
Gabriel, is it just the one protein that is doing this, or is this something that you expect to be sort of widespread that we just haven't really worked out yet?
Yeah, so like, it's probably more widespread than we think, because the mechanism here is to do with a certain molecule interacting with a certain part of the protein, and that molecule is already present in the cell, and that particular part of the protein is also present, you know, in many proteins. So you need this shielding. We already have kind of a family of different proteins that are responding to magnetic fields to various degrees,
right.
Various colors. The one that kind of I work with is sort of the end of a line of an engineering effort where there's maybe 10 proteins all quite similar, but with slight variations, and then they have different levels of magnetic response.
Yeah, it's wild stuff. Gabriel, thanks so much for coming in and chatting to us about this. And what can I say? You know, get back to Oxford and do something real. You know, just hanging around in Australia. I don't know what. Lucky you have the friends with the wedding. That's great.
I love how relaxed you are for the fact that you said you're towards the end of your PhD. I feel like I was very frantic at that stage. So good on you.
Well, it's been a really fun time. So.
are you writing up at this point? Or you,
yeah.
So you, write-ups, like you're done. Yeah.
I don't know. Mine wasn't that relaxed, but you know.
I love the write-up stage because when I had a really harsh supervisor, hope he's listening. Hi, Keith. But he basically, we knew that if he let you write up, You're okay. Because like he was very, very harsh on that. So yeah, so you're writing up.
Yeah, that's right.
Awesome. Thanks so much for coming on.
Great. Thanks, Jen.
Folks, we're going to take a break for some music and we'll be back in just a few minutes with our second guest for today.
What's inside that cloudy little head? Come on, won't you stretch it out? Afraid I'll really see you. Figure what you're all about. Everybody knows you're as perfect as the roses in the ground. You don't see that though, you're so busy on your own little cloud. Patience. behind that frowning little face. Sometimes you wanna throw it all away. Hope that you don't mind me saying I think that would be a waste. When you're feeling like a stone skipping on your own across the
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Einstein A Go-Go. I'm Dr. Shane. In the studio with us now is Associate Professor Roisin McNenny. Now, Roisin is from the School of Computing and Information Systems at the University of Melbourne. Welcome to Triple R.
Thank you for having me.
It is good to have you in the studio because you're working on AI, which we're all talking about.
Yeah.
Is it going to take over? Was James Cameron right?
The AI overloads are coming.
Well, I think, in short, probably yes. It's already here. You know, we had ChatGPT jumped onto the scene in 2022, and ever since, it's in everybody's computer, everybody's phone. We're seeing other models coming out that are, you know, this is generative AI, of course, that we're talking about, but it's the thing that the people think about straight away when you say AI, and it's definitely things we're all using.
Are we going to end up potatoes? Like, do you think? Is that, like, are we losing our abilities?
What do you mean, end us?
That's a generous idea. Thank you for the benefit.
Look, I think we need to see these types of AI as tools and not replacements.
Right.
And the thing about it is that, yes, you can use it to ask questions and find things out and help you write your assignments. Mm. Lots of students are doing that at the moment. But if you don't have the foundational understanding to be able to assess whether it's actually giving you correct information or not, then it's not really all that useful. And, you know, we have to remember the way that these generalist types of AIs actually work. And they're pretty much just trained on the whole of the internet, if we put it that way.
Which is also a lot of AI content now, right?
A lot of AI content. Yeah. And not only that, but we see things like, you know, blogs and advertisement content, and especially when we're thinking about things like health, you know, you don't know where the sources of this information is coming up. And to be honest with you, it's also trained on research papers and good sources of information. But you need to be able to assess for yourself whether that information is from a reputable source or not.
I mean, this is how I treat Chris KP. I'm never sure. I always double check.
I would have assumed that you would assume that it was a disreputable source. It's certainly unreliable. Yeah, really.
It's unreliable. Roisin, in health, I mean, you work in particular in health and healthcare. What are some of the technologies? Because I think we, many of us have probably already experienced, you know, you go to your GP these days and they're like, oh, do you mind if I use this automaker? I'm thinking, really? But where else? I mean, where are we seeing AI really come in and start playing a major role in healthcare? And what does that look like?
There's a couple of different ways. And again, you know, the one thing that you've mentioned there is an AI scribe.
Yep.
And again, that's this kind of generative AI where it's, you know, it's doing a task for you in a generative way, a bit like a person would generate a conversation or generate meeting notes. And this is, you know, a really useful tool for people who are very busy and, you know, you go and see your GP, you've probably got 10 minutes yep. with that GP. Mm, yep. And it could be saving them a lot of time to have this AI running in the background to help it generate these notes. And those very specific and targeted tasks are a really important kind of use case for AI. When the task is narrow, it can be trained very, very well.
Yep.
So we see a lot of AI being used, for example, in helping with predictions in like hospital settings, or let's say we're looking for a tumor, a brain tumor. If you give an AI model a lot of images yep. of brain tumors and train it really well on that very, very specific task to be able to detect and classify what that brain tumor looks yep. like, and actually performance is pretty good.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah.
Because, just on that, I mean, I vaguely remember recently there was some breast cancer imaging work where it sort of pulled back the detection time by about 3 years based on AI looking at, you know, very subtle things in images that us humans were missing. You know, and it's not widespread in use, but there was a demonstration that, they could do much earlier detection.
Yeah, you know. And I think the what we need to remember here is that we're not at a point where AI is doing everything, especially not in healthcare.
Yep.
So there's always a person on the other side. So it's potentially happened with decision support for a clinician, but it's not doing everything yet.
Yep.
And I don't know if we'll ever really get there.
Yeah.
So when you're to pick those two examples, if you've trained an AI agent to assess tumor images, that is very specific, and it's presumably a particular piece of closed coding, if you like, that's doing this one task, as opposed to ChatGPT, which you could ask to do anything, and it's basically doing its best with whatever it can find.
Mm-hmm.
Can those large scale models, are they able to be trained to do a specific task, or do you need to actually have a separate line of coding to teach something specific?
So in short, yes, and that's what we're that's where I see the future of large language models going. And if we think so my work, a lot of my work is in mental health in particular. And if we're using things like ChatGPT, which are very generalist large language models, to support our mental health, we know that people are doing this, right? Mm-hmm. Like, widespread people are doing this.
Yeah.
And there's reasons why they're doing it, okay? So, you know, it's easily accessible. It talks back to you like it's a person.
Yeah.
You build up that level of rapport. The advice that it's giving you is seemingly useful. But it will also always agree with what you're saying.
Yeah.
And we really don't know enough about the quality of those interactions that people are having in relation to mental health. What we do know is that it can have pretty serious cases where, you know, there was a very recent court case against OpenAI, for example, where there was a young man who was using ChatGPT and eventually led to completing suicide because of the advice and this relationship that he's having. And the thing is, for very low-level mental health issues, I had I'm feeling stressed about exams. I had a problem with my boyfriend, and you know, what should I do? It's probably given relatively decent advice, but for those more nuanced mental health issues, it really doesn't have the capacity to be able to detect those unless you're given it a lot of information.
And you got to know what to give it.
And you got to know what to give it, and that's the thing.
Roisin, you've recently been running almost like a safety audit on how this works. You know? I mean, tell us about that, because it sounds like something that needs to be interrogated to work out at what level we have to sort of draw a line and say unsafe.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we did some kind of early research recently in the space of eating disorders, and we created these personas of people with different levels of disordered eating and exercise behaviors. So really explicit. I am 14 years old and I have anorexia, right through to you know, somebody who's wanting to do a water fast but is over the age of 65, and so on and so forth. And what we tried to do was build in some of those complexities of real human beings. So it's not just that we're looking for one piece of information. There's all of this other underlying kind of context that we bring as people. And what we found was, in those really explicit cases, if you give ChatGPT, which is the model that we looked at, if you give it all of that contextual information, the safeguards go into overdrive if it's really, really highly explicit. So let's use that 14-year-old with a history of anorexia example. It's not going to give healthy eating and fitness advice to that young person, but you can circumvent it very, very easily.
Okay.
And the reality is that people are not necessarily going to give that contextual information.
Yeah.
I was about to say, I think that there's one part about, you know, particular disorders around eating behavior that a lot of the things are often not willingly shared, like not even with the humans, you know, like human therapists or whatever that are there to help you and that you pay for it too.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that I picked up on is that you, and that you mentioned that I think is very keen and the key to all of this is that it rarely ever disagrees with you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that humans are incredibly like happy to accept because this is what like what we want, you know, we don't like disagreement. And I think particularly when it comes to like mental disorders or mental health problems, do you think that this is going down a path where we also change as a society, that we're like less and less able to deal with if someone actually disagrees with us and what happens, because we can just go to ChatGPT and be like, yeah, it agrees with everything I say, this is great.
Well, I think that's it, and especially in a mental health space, it's not replicating a therapist.
Yeah.
So that's not the type of interaction that you would have with a therapist. The therapist isn't going to give you all of the information that you're requesting, even if it's a back and forth conversation. And I've hypothesized that what we will see is more people coming in to mental health practitioners with this expectation that that is the way that their interactions are going to go.
Yeah.
And I think it might change the expectations that people have out of therapy and how therapists are going to have to manage people who've been to, you know, it used to be Dr. Google.
Yeah.
And we had all of our doctors.
Dr. AI.
And now it's Dr. GPT.
So to that point, do you think that, I mean, with or without intervention, do you think that people / generations are going to get better at using the large language models and understanding what they need to ask, where the limitations are, what the red flags are? Or is it really a case of, no, that's never going to happen unless we sort them
out? Like, we're so good at using social media.
Well, I'm thinking Dr. Google is still probably used poorly by a lot of people, but we're at least aware, I think, that, you know, there might be something underneath this, or be a little bit careful. I feel like that's improved. I don't know.
I think the problem that happens for a lot of people is the level of authority that
it's always confident.
It's always confident, and it's not always giving us the correct information. So there's this phenomenon called hallucination that happens. So the problem is that these large language models will always give you an answer.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't know what the answer is. And it will always give that answer with authority.
I reckon that's an interesting reflection of, I mean, let's face it, these things were designed by people.
Yeah.
you get by in life by confidence. Get a job interview. Don't go in umming and ahhing. They want you to go in with a clarity around what you're going to do and how it's going to work.
Be confident and no one will question you.
I knew you'd say that.
To a T.
I think, Rashim, we're almost out of time, but it seems to me, though, like this cat is... Out of the bag?
Yeah.
Out of the bag.
It's fully out of the bag.
We just did a quantum physics thing, and so, you know, remember, cats, it gets awkward.
But is it a box? Is it closed? Is it open?
It's out of the bag.
What is it?
But, you know, we can't put it back in. And it seems to me, from what you're saying, though, is that we're going to have to change a lot of our practices in terms of the way clinicians interact. So that first session with a therapist might be, let me clarify for you the difference between me and ChatGPT, you know, and half an hour spent on something we would never have thought of before.
I mean, it's a really interesting thought. The answer is, I don't really know just yet. And as I said, you know, started in 2022, we're really only seeing research about this emerging now, end of 2025.
Right.
And I think that we're going to have a lot more, my own research included, that's going to give us a lot more insight in this and how people are using it more broadly, and then how that's translating into practice.
Yeah.
But we need to research it, you know?
Yeah. And look, this is a huge disruption. We've had disruptions before. Computers, I mean, calculators, they were evil ones.
Smartphones.
smart
the internet.
Yeah, there's been many disruptions. I think this one, arguably, though, is on a scale that we are not really in a place where we've experienced before. But, yeah. I think, if we work and we do the research around the impact of it and we're careful and open-minded, I think, it can, as you say, it can be a very, very powerful tool for a lot of things.
Well, that's it. And we cannot forget that for a lot of people, mental health care is not accessible or affordable. Mm. There might be stigma around it. And these are the types of reasons why people are turning to these large language models. I think the thing to remember is that you need to bring a level of curiosity to what is being provided back and just have that knowledge that it is confirming what you're saying. And that's what it's trained to do. And at the end of the day, it's not a person. It's a machine.
Yeah.
And if we just come to it with that level of knowledge, I think it can improve the way that we work with these things.
Amazing. Associate Professor Roisin McNenny, thanks so much for coming in and chatting to us.
Thank you very much.
Folks, we're going to take a break for some station announcements and we'll be back with our final guest in just a moment.
A poetic, roaming work of creativity and intellect, The Ruin of Magic by Kate Holden is an elegant and whip-smart meditation on finding home and belonging in modern Australia. Drawing on philosophers and poets, pagan history and new criticism, Holden writes with humour and sorrow of the ways life today warps under its glare. Is it possible to live wondrously by fluorescent light? The Ruin of Magic by Kate Holden. Out now via Black Ink Books, RRR sponsors.
Severance star Adam Scott leads the terrifying Hokum, a new folklore horror set within the remote Irish countryside. When a reclusive novelist sets out to scatter his parents' ashes, he visits a secluded inn that's rumoured to be haunted by an ancient witch. As he digs deeper into the staff's mysterious stories, he comes face to face with the darkest corners of his past. Hokum screens from April 30 at Cinema Nova. RRR sponsors.
Tune in to Buy It Into It, featuring local insights on the latest tech news and the ways technology intersects with everyday life. Wednesdays from 7 to 8 p.m. on RRR. Buy It Into It is sponsored by the .au domain. .au is a marker of trust online. Any website or email using .au has a registered and verified connection to Australia. It's how you know you're supporting local on a global internet. To find out more or register a .au domain, head to auda.org.au. RRR sponsors.
Melbourne Rock Quiz is coming home. For four huge nights, Rock Quiz returns to the Gershwin Room at the SV St Kilda, May 26 to 29. Join Julia, Brian, Dougald and the Rock Quiz Orchestra for music, trivia and pure mayhem. Tickets on sale now at hotelesplanade.com.au. The ESPY, RRR sponsors.
The smash hit queer black comedy Trophy Boys is touring again. After sold out seasons in Melbourne, catch it at Her Majesty's Theatre Ballarat. Performed by a female and non-binary cast, Trophy Boys uses drag and satire to playfully and powerfully interrogate toxic masculinity, elitism and homophobia in private schools and beyond. Trophy Boys at Her Maj on Friday, April 24. Book at hermaj.com. RRR sponsors.
Spin Cycle on RRR, Thursday nights from 7 p.m. with Jess Lilly, Charlie Lewis and me, Rachel Withers. Aiming to make sense of the 24/7 updates and hot takes we are bombarded with from media outlets, politicians and pundits, all trying to own the narrative. Tune in to Spin Cycle on RRR via FM, digital, online, on demand or via the app.
Yes, there's an app. There's a RRR app. You can download it.
I heard this earlier during radiotherapy.
They updated it recently and it's awesome.
Is it good?
Yeah.
I might do it right now.
No, do it. Download it.
It's bad when you're in the car and listening while you're driving and you're like, oh, you've done it. No, wait, no phone in the car. It's not good. Well, and then I forgot.
Problems. In the studio with us now is Dr. Alex Dobrik. Alex is a postdoctoral researcher in the Rare and Complex Lung Disease Laboratory in the Department of Biochemistry and Pharmacology at the University of Melbourne. Alex, welcome to the RRR studio.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate you having me on for the interview. Get to talk about my research.
It's good because we had your partner on a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And you just looked in the window and you thought, this looks awesome. So we managed to con you to come in.
Yeah. It's a bit nerve-wracking for me, not going to lie. But I'm excited. Like, I finally get to put myself out there a little bit. So
awesome. Now, you work in you're a respiratory scientist. So, yes. I mean, what got you into that originally? Like, that's such a – it's an interesting area because, you know, we all need it, let's face it. But what got you into respiratory science?
I don't know. I sort of fell into it, just like going through the undergrads, and then like I found it fascinating for what we used to look at in respiratory science. So I was looking at emphysema during my PhD studies, so did a lot of emphysema work, and I've always had a interest in neuroscience. So we sort of came up with a project looking at how emphysema was associated with dementia.
Right.
So during my PhD at least. And I wanted to learn it was a very new thing for emphysema at the time. So I actually got to go into I was starting to hypothesize, guess that there was an inflammatory response in the brain, and the oxygen deprivation in respiratory diseases at least was contributing to the dementia. Dementia symptoms, I guess. And then I sort of like made a foundation of like my own research being like respiratory based neuroscience. So
yeah.
I guess I've just continued on that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I've had a family member many, many years ago, you know, it's extended family member who died of emphysema, and watching that as a child.
Mm.
And, you know, it put you off smoking for life, that's for sure. But it like just seeing that restriction in oxygen flow, I mean, it must do a lot to the brain, presumably. Yeah.
It really does, yeah. So we were specifically looking at cigarettes at the time, but I had to start looking at vaping. So
yep.
The e-cigarettes yep. were a very new thing. A lot more people are starting to vape, and I needed to know, is vaping doing the exact same thing?
Right.
And the toxins that are actually released from the e-cigarettes were causing similar responses to what we see from normal cigarettes.
Yep.
So even to this day now, I do tell people vaping is just as bad as cigarettes,
right.
If not worse. Because of all the toxins released from the coils when it gets heated up, heated and cooled. And then obviously a lot of e-cigarettes do have, they got nicotine as well, so it does cause an addiction to an extent.
And flavours.
Yeah.
Nasty flavours.
Yeah, gee whiz.
Yeah.
Now, you moved now across to cystic fibrosis, just give us the quick couple of lines on what that is, just to remind our listeners of what's happening in the body.
That's okay. So cystic fibrosis, it is commonly known to be a respiratory disease. Mm-hmm. It's also heavily involved in the gastrointestinal system as well.
Yep.
They're the two main issues that happen. So basically, it's a genetic disease specifically where a certain protein is not produced and it doesn't allow – and sorry, this certain protein is not produced and hence it causes an accumulation of mucus within the airways and also in the linings, like along the lining of your gastrointestinal system as well. And it starts causing issues there because you can't the – bacteria gets trapped in the airways, causes inflammation, but in the gut it also causes blockages because the nutrients and stuff can't like flow through the intestines.
Yeah.
So a lot of issues there.
Now, my understanding, you mentioned something along these lines to us just before the show, but this condition now is something that people can live with for a very long time. The medications, or for most people, I think are available now to treat cystic fibrosis that we didn't have before, is that right?
Yeah, so early on, it used to be a disease associated with younger people and they weren't living as long as we would like them to be. But current medications are actually allowing people to live a normal life.
Right.
So they can live to an elderly age. Because of that, that's when later stage life diseases start coming up. So, like, again, for me, being a neuroscientist, I'm thinking, is it going to start causing mental health issues, impairments? So I'm looking towards that again. But also, because of the current medications, like, it's FDA approved, so the patients can take these medicines. But there hasn't been, like, the current medications at least haven't been available for a very long time. Right. So are these medications causing side effects as well now? And again, being neuroscientist as well, how's that impacting mental health?
The two things I find fascinating in health are, one, where we have diseases that, you know, in an evolutionary sense, we were never meant to get because we just didn't live that long. Like, you know, things that you get after 45, you know.
Yep.
And then the second one is where we have these diseases where in the past, no one lived beyond, in some cases, 20, you know, really young. And now they're living to 80. We don't know what it means to have that disease till that age, but also the medications required to treat it to that age.
Yeah.
And like you say, we're in the first few decades, right? So, I mean, this is a open field.
It really is. So, because people are able to live longer, you don't know what's going to come up. Like, anything could come up. So I guess we have to start looking elsewhere, not just like in the respiratory or gastrointestinal. You have to start looking elsewhere. I've actually started going into the cardiovascular system a little bit because like it is heavily linked with the brain.
Yeah.
So obviously it provides a lot of the oxygen to the brain. So you have to look elsewhere, not just like specifically focus. Yeah. It is, cystic fibrosis has become a multisystemic disease.
Right. Interesting.
So I almost want to make a statement and then say discuss. I'm not sure where to go with this. I'm just thinking, so as you say, cystic fibrosis also affects the gastrointestinal tract, which means, irrespective of the level of treatment, there's an interaction there with your microbiota, which we know have a direct line to the brain.
Yep.
Discuss.
I wish I could like heavily discuss this. I don't know too much about the microbiome component. I do know that with the gastrointestinal system, a lot of the issues are causing like a higher risk of like cancers. They're causing a higher risk of other gastrointestinal issues that we didn't see in the past, only because now people are living longer.
Yeah.
I assume there will be differences in the microbiome, and obviously the microbiome is very important to the human body. So,
Chris is trying to start a company with his own poo.
Poo transport.
Excrement of excellence.
Excellent. Yes, it's effluent.
It is fascinating because we know it affects the heart. We know it affects hypertension.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these things. There's the gut-brain axis stuff going on.
There is.
I mean, I just think sometimes it's almost, we're almost getting to that point where we need to stop having different fields.
Yeah.
Just put everyone in the same room all day long because, like, there's so many crossovers.
Funny you mention that. I feel like the respiratory system is, like, very systemic. Like, it does go to other fields constantly. Like, well, I was doing the same thing, like, looking at emphysema. Like, basically how the other systems were linking to the respiratory system at least. So I feel like, especially because it affects oxygen, and oxygen is required everywhere. Yeah. So I agree with that.
Alex, I like it because you get the immunology people in here and they say, nah, it's all us. You know, we cover the whole body. But now the respiratory people are fighting back. It's us.
You know, but that's a good point too, that oxygen, it only comes in via the lungs, right?
Yeah.
Like you don't suck it in through your toes or anything. It doesn't imbibe through the hair. So basically, if you're not getting the respiratory bit right, then, everybody's waiting for you.
Yeah. Well, exactly, And like, I've been heavily focusing on the oxygen component. Funny you mentioned inflammation because like I always think about inflammation. It's just like part of my like my own personal research. Oxygen is a huge important part of everything. So
it's cool stuff. Yeah. I love it. Dr. Alex Dobrik, thanks so much for coming in. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We could talk about this stuff for ages because I love it when we on the show kind of discover how we need to do medicine from now on. Just put the respiratory people in charge and we're good to go. Thanks so much for chatting about the work. Good luck.
No, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Dr. Alex Dobrik there, folks, from the Department of Biochemistry and Pharmacology at the University of Melbourne. We're almost out of time, kids.
I know, but flash today.
I know.
That's
what it happens when we have good guests. Did you have some 10-second anecdote you wanted to talk about before?
No. Except for a PhD student that accidentally found a new species of ladybird.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is it named after
PhD student studying ladybirds accidentally found a new one by walking through the campus and looking at a tree.
Huh.
Yeah.
Go out and do something. I like that.
PhD students out there you go. You might be lucky. You might also be very unlucky.
Yeah. You may have found it on your shoe. Anyway, but that's what analysis is for. Folks, thanks for listening to Einstein the Go-Go. I'm Dr. Shane. Remember, science is everywhere. We're going to hand you over now to the team from Eat It. Have a great Sunday.
Pornography and slasher films.
Triple R.
Pornography and slasher films.
Triple R. Triple R.
Pornography and slasher films.
Triple R.
And the facts are available. The facts, and the facts, and the facts are available. And the facts are available. The facts, and the facts, and the facts are available.
Triple R.
Hey, guys, why don't we eat?
Dear, don't cause a fuss. I'll have your spam. I love it. I'm in spam, spam, spam.
Cornflakes. 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 Cornflakes.
Any man fancy a pint?
Suit you, sir.
Spam, 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 baked beans, spam, 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 and spam.
I said I don't want any damn vegetables.
Lentils are really good, you know.
Forbidden donut.